You are absolutely playing two games simultaneously. And I would say that the old school ethos tends much more heavily to be based on the idea of you are playing to win rather than you are playing to evoke a character. But that idea of playing to evoke a character, which, you know, also dates back to, you know, 1974, this is not a new idea, but it became, you ran into a period of time in the game where suddenly all of the people, suddenly seemed to be talking about role-playing, and they were looking down their noses at the people who were trying to play with player skill. Well, of course it's more important to be role-playing your character. And, I think a lot of the old stories were like, no, why is that the case? It's a game. You know, there is a skill element to it. What do I lose by not accurately portraying, you know, this particular, you know, hobbit? It's a fairly minimal difference one way or the other, so...
Welcome to the Dungeon Plunger Podcast. My name is Jason Weeb, and this is the show in which I, a real-life janitor and dungeon master, teaches you how to plunge in and run a better Dungeons & Dragons game. Without further ado, let's plunge into this week's episode. An interview with the OSR Godfather.
Hit it!
Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I'm happy to present the first published interview that I've done so far, and I am interviewing Matt Finch, and he is, well, you'll find out, he's the creator, if you don't already know, of the Swords and Wizardry rule set, and he was kind enough to share an hour and a bit of his time with me, so I hope you enjoy this, and I look forward to hearing any sort of feedback you have on it. And please support the Osric backer kit. Alrighty, without further ado, let's hit it.
Let's get it on.
Welcome, Dungeon Plunger Union members. I have my plus one plunger, a steaming hot cup of holy water blessed by St. Keurig, and I have a very special union member with me today to help me plunge the dungeon and flush evil down the drain. Welcome, Matt Finch.
Hello.
Matt is the founding figure of the OSR, the man behind Mythmir Games, the author of Osric, Swords and Wizardry, the Tome of Adventure Design, and much, much more. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Matt. I really, really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Thanks. So real talk, Matt. How many fantasy RPG systems does one gamer actually need to have?
Three.
Oh, okay. Which ones?
Wait, is this fantasy or cross-genre?
I'm just thinking like fantasy because I think there's like 200 of them minimum.
Yeah, I'd say two.
Two? What would be your two choices?
Well, mine are probably pretty well known. It's, you know, OD&D, for when you're, when you're flying, with the whole, whatever works kind of approach. And then, AD&D, if you want something that's crunchier and more of a war game and something that's going to hold together. So, I'm definitely go with the, crunchy versus non-crunchy dualism there.
Okay. Yeah, that was going to be that was one of my sort of questions in terms of like, so right now you're running your backer kit for Osric, which is the old school reference and index compilation for the third edition of that. And so I was a little curious as to like, you have Swords and Wizardry and Osric, so why support the two? So that makes sense that that's sort of your philosophy, is one is a little less rules crunchy than the other.
Yeah. I mean, I would say that there's the differences between, and we're kind of in angels dancing on the head of a pin territory, because it's already pre-selected for the fact that I don't tend to like games where you have, intelligence or wisdom baked into the rules, because I prefer to have puzzles for the players that the players are sorting out. So that already, sort of tends, in terms of my preferences, tends to remove a large number of games from it. And so, I'm left with the two, call it old school types of games where one, you know, AD&D Osric is crunchier than OD&D, and there are sort of other differences too. I mean, OD&D tends to have a feel of, you know, things could go really well or really bad, and Osric tends to have somewhat smaller parameters because it's, you know, again, it's fairly well gauged toward, you know, having the game not break at the point that you hit 12th level, 15th level. It holds, you know, one of the constant comments that you get about, you know, AD&D first edition is that it really holds together very well at high levels, where you need to do a little bit of work usually in any other system to make things stick together well at high levels. But so that's why I would pick those two, is it's really more of a crunchy versus beer and pretzels kind of dualism, what kind of game I'm in the mood for.
I'm a little curious now. So what would be the other non-fantasy games then?
You know, I like Traveller for science fiction. So for me, it's just, you know, there are only a few other genres that I like to play in over something longer than a one-shot game. And so, you know, Traveller, in a couple of the different editions of Traveller are good. But, you know, I'm really into the sort of, you know, Firefly, Mos Eisley, you know, Traveller, you know, vibe in terms of my science fiction gaming. So Traveller, but, you know, there's other games I'd pull in for a one-shot type of thing for other genres as well. But for me, it's, you know, the preferred genres that I stick in are pretty much, you know, either, you know, D&D type fantasy or, you know, Traveller, you know, on the gritty edge of the universe.
Okay. So we're talking like Classic Traveller or Mongoose Traveller or...
I like both of those. I mean, I'm more familiar with Classic Traveller, but okay. That's just a familiarity thing. I think I haven't seen a really bad edition of Traveller. They're, you know, they're different from one to the next, but they all work.
Okay, that's cool. So for some of my listeners, they're going to know immediately who you are. And for, you know, at least half of them, they're going to have no idea who you are and why you're so special. So tell us a little bit about your RPG street cred.
Well, so mainly, you know, I started doing RPG writing, you know, around the time of third edition, a couple years in, when a bunch of the people who liked the pre-third edition version of Dungeons & Dragons began clustering on the internet. And, you know, this is fairly early days in the internet. So we're talking, you know, it's forums, nothing like the level of social media that's out there right now. So it was sort of a slow accumulation of people who liked the pre-third edition versions. And what I did was, you know, the then current version of the game, third edition, was being released under the OGL. There was a lot of open game content for it, and that wasn't available for people who played the earlier editions because for a couple of different reasons. But if you were using the OGL, you couldn't then use the trademark. And so there was what I did was basically, you know, the first step was in 2005 and released in 2006 was with Stuart Marshall, who is the co-author of Osric, because it's not just me. But although I did the first part of writing on it, but then he sort of finished it up. What we did was we rewrote, the basic rules for first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, literally rewrote. There are outs under copyright law that, you know, game mechanics can't be, copyrighted. It's under the fair use exemption. And then we also brought in the OGL at that point because that gave us coverage in terms of the terms and concepts. But basically, you know, to make a very long and boring story short, we sort of created a completely alternate version of AD&D that didn't violate copyright. And then we put a trademark on it and said, you can use this trademark to refer to stuff that you do yourself. It was a tool for publishers. We didn't really at that point think that people were going to adopt it as the rules used for the game. But since we had organized it in a more modern manner, there were an enormous number of people who picked it up and said, hey, this is a better learning tool for learning to play the rules of AD&D than the original books themselves, which, you know, a lot of people were like, you know, I like the original books better for the flavor and the, you know, the deeper style and so on and so forth. But for actually learning it, this is what I actually want to be handing out to new players who haven't played it before. And so it got, you know, a lot of use at the game table. And where we are right now with this backer kit is trying to even increase that more, because we were writing it as a, we were writing it as a reference edition. It was being used as a teaching edition. And so now we're going back to it and saying, okay, let's focus on teaching edition here, you know, because that's what it's really being used for in the gaming community, is the sort of onboarding process of, you know, learning the game in the first place. So I've gotten off track, I think, from your question, but we're talking about cred. So that was Osric. And then a couple of years after Osric, I basically did the same thing with original Dungeons and Dragons, which is the little box set. And if we are on YouTube, I will show the box set. And if we are not on YouTube, then no one will know what I'm holding up. But that's the box set of original D&D that actually came before first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And so it was, you know, producing the same sort of thing for that, so that people could write adventure modules for it and publish them and refer to a trademark and so on and so forth. So that's the, and then, I've also written, Tome of Adventure Design, which is a fairly popular book, Tome of World Building that's out there. But the, you know, for the purposes of talking about being a good, game master, well, those are relevant too, actually. But they're sort of a tool for doing the adventure designing and the world designing. So that's probably a topic for a different day. But that's the street cred on the rules.
Well, I mean, I was a little curious about what the difference between, or not so much the difference, but the distinction between the Tome of Adventure Design versus, is it Adventure Design? Is it, do I have that right? There's
Tome of Adventure Design is all about building an adventure. And it's pretty much, you know, a step-by-step process all the way through of, you know, random tables and, you know, idea hooks. And, you know, it's fairly comprehensive, but it's really about adventure. And then World Building was a book that I didn't write for many, many years after, because I couldn't see really how exactly I wanted to organize that. But Tome of World Building, which has a companion volume, the Nomicon, which is about making generating names using tables, and that's really about creating a campaign setting. Although it's got the philosophy of writing behind it, that you're not writing the setting just for the purpose of having a setting. You're writing a setting with the purpose of creating adventure hooks. And, you know, it's for use in a role-playing game. So that's what that is sort of focused on.
Okay. So, when exactly did you get into the hobby? Was that like the white box that you showed, or was it earlier
than that?
Yeah. I was going to say, is it like later than that?
The Bullionic Wargaming or Braunstein or I got into the hobby at about 1978, although because I had been, as a kid, I mean, I'm like 10 years old at this point, but I had actually been doing some Napoleonic wargaming, or at least reading about Napoleonic wargaming and playing, you know, with soldiers and so forth, with some Napoleonic soldiers. And so I had been at a convention, you know, went to hobby stores, saw OD&D out there, and was curious about it, but didn't really. And also, I saw like the monster manual, and couldn't really understand, you know, what game is this for. I figured it was for some war game. Didn't see a box set anywhere that said Dungeons and Dragons on it. So it wasn't until a friend of mine actually got a hold of the copy of the Holmes Basic set, which was sometime in 1978, and we sat down and played it. And we're like, yeah, okay, and we're hooked. And at that point in time, or very shortly thereafter, so shortly that I don't even know that there was a difference in time, was the Player's Handbook for Advanced Dungeons and Dragons was out there. And so I got a copy of that, And so then we sort of started playing a hybrid game that was the Holmes rules plus the character classes from Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. And so I did not start with the OD&D rules, although, you know, you had to find yourself a copy of those and either photocopy it or something, because since they had not released the Dungeon Master's Guide yet, I don't think that came out till 79, all of the saving throw information and stuff like that was not in the player's handbook of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which I know sounds very odd to somebody who started later, but the saving throw information was not player-facing. That was a DM tool. So it was in the other book. So you had to go to OD&D and find a copy. So we did play with OD&D as part of this kind of hybrid game, but I did not actually start with pure OD&D. I didn't really start playing pure OD&D until actually after I had done Swords and Wizardry, which was at the request of somebody that ran the forum. A guy named Jerry Mates asked me if I would do one, a retro clone of OD&D, because it was his game. And then I realized as I was doing it, you know, oh my gosh, this is actually slightly closer to the way I play than Advanced Dungeons and Dragons is. And so it definitely, you know, did become my game of choice, but that wasn't until, you know, many, many, many years later after I actually started.
Okay. Do you prefer GMing or playing?
GMing.
Okay. And so one of my questions is, like, do you have a preference on the title of what the game master should be called? I've seen some debate about whether, you know, it should be a referee or a game master or a judge. What's your take?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't have a preference that I would, you know, try and push on anybody. My view is that referee is probably the best description of the way that I try and run games. But, you know, I think there's a lot of different, you know, I think if people do have a strong preference, that probably tells you a little bit about the style that they use when they're running a game. You know, mine would be referee, I think.
Okay. So for my listeners who may not know, give us the sales pitch for Osric that's crowdfunding on BackerKit right now.
Oh, well, you know, it's a clone of first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons. We don't have that trademark, so I'm always having to put in the little legal disclaimer of, you know, we're not affiliated with Wizards of the Coast. But yeah, it's a clone version of first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons, which has certain characteristics to it. Like I said, you know, it's a very old school game in the sense that it doesn't have rules for, you know, wisdom or intelligence actually allowing you to solve puzzles. You know, that's based on the player skill at solving puzzles. There's some discussion about, you know, the pillars of adventure, which ones it emphasizes, which ones it doesn't. I would say it's, you know, it's an old school, if you like, you know, old school, you know, sort of ethos, if you like crunchy rules for that, then that's probably your game. If you don't like crunchy rules, you may want something that's a little bit more free-formed, like, you know, Swords and Wizardry or any other OD&D clone. Obviously, nobody can afford the original OD&D books at this point. The ones for AD&D are actually available print on demand to drive through. So there's not going to be a shortage of those ones. But, you know, I would say, you know, it's a terrible elevator pitch, but the thing is, it's a relatively niche thing, but a lot of people really are curious, you know, about first edition Advanced Dungeons and Dragons because it's the version that they're playing in Stranger Things, if nothing else. And that's where Eddie, you know, takes the bow and, you know, there's a lot of interest in that edition, and it's always had a very, very, you know, loyal base of players that have just not gone away. That's the game, and they really, you know, evaluated other games and prefer to stick with that one. It's got a very, very strong core thing. It's got a lot of free resources that have been made for it over the years. So it's a very, very robust community of gamers. And I think really the question of should I be one of those gamers probably has a lot to do with what sorts of rules, you know, you prefer to be running in your game, you know, there are a lot of different choices for which game system is going to support the way in which you either run a game or play in a game.
So I was looking at some, like, doing a little bit of research. I watched some of your other interviews that you've done in the past. And on one of the interview, you were discussing the Swords and Wizardry Book of Options. And you had mentioned about how you have the wizard class, the warlock class in that book. And it was an attempt at bringing people whose RPG background comes from the newer editions, like specifically like fifth edition. Do you play fifth edition, or have you played fifth edition? And how does that affect these modern versions of games? How has that affected you in terms of how you play and how you design games?
I have played 5th edition, played it pretty solidly for a couple of years, mainly because I had a YouTube show where I was running adventures. And so in the same campaign, I was running one group using OD&D and one group using 5th edition. So yeah, I'm pretty familiar with 5th edition, you know, as it existed shortly after it first came out. Really the core books and a couple of the supplements, but by no means the full sweep of what got produced, you know, in between then and now. How has that affected it? I would say other than giving me a sense of how fifth edition gamers gestalt view an RPG, I wouldn't really say it's influenced very much. But I think each edition, you know, when the designers of that official edition made the changes, they made them for a particular reason and to go in a particular direction. I mean, my sense is that fifth edition was actually an attempt to go back to some of the earlier pre-2000 mechanisms than third edition had been. Because third edition has the characteristic of a fair number of modifiers being added to die rolls. I mean, you could end up with, you know, 6 or 7 modifiers from here, there, and the other thing as a result of, and I think, you know, the earlier editions didn't have that because a lot of it was collapsed into a cookie cutter type character class. You know, your character class did certain things and therefore you didn't need a lot of modifiers because you weren't doing very much tailoring of your character development. And third edition definitely built in tailoring of character development. And then fifth edition, I think, was like, you know what, this is a fair amount of math, so let's take some of these character development concepts, lump them together into a particular chunk, you know, like a path, and say, okay, so now we've got a character class, but there's a path that incorporates but eliminates the math from a lot of the directions that third edition would have been taking it. And so, you know, that, and you can see them avoiding math again, like in the advantage-disadvantage system. So I think that was one of the things they were trying to do, is to re-chunk the way that some of this information or some of this rules data was being presented, rather than having it completely broken down where the player was adding this and this and this and this and this and this and this. So I think each new edition does come with a sort of design philosophy that creates a sort of gestalt view of what the game is in the people who learn to play using that edition.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I feel like fifth edition sort of had that hybrid kind of third edition slash, I guess, older first edition type of mentality, right? And even fourth edition, you know, just trying to take from each of the best things from each of the editions and trying to make something that's going to make everybody kind of happy. I don't really think that's exactly.
Never do that.
So in that same interview, you talked about how the philosophy of how to play old school games, which I think is really, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like is at the core of what it is to play an old school game, is that you have to have the right philosophy. Would you agree with that?
Unless you stumble into it accidentally. I mean, those of us who actually started playing with those old editions had no idea that we were following a particular philosophy. There were no rules for solving puzzles, and so you had the players solve the puzzles. So, you know, we, you know, just sort of, you know, I've had a lot of younger people who are coming into the OSR say, hey, were you thinking at that time about rulings versus rules? No, we didn't need to. We didn't have any alternatives. That was just the way you did it. It's just that, you know, now looking back, we're like, yeah, and I still prefer the way that that worked out to be. But no, there wasn't a philosophy behind it. But and a lot of the OSR has been trying to retro figure out what was the philosophy that I was playing with back then, because I want to be able to put it in terms that, you know, someone who's just coming to it might understand, or even just to, you know, improve my own game by understanding these are the things. But, you know, at the beginning of those game systems, I don't think anybody sees the philosophy of the game they learn to play with. They right. take it as a given. And that's why you can learn, you know, you can make a lot of probable assumptions about the way somebody's going to view a game by asking, which edition did you start with? Because that's going to be the one that they're taking as the bedrock foundation of what an RPG is.
Yeah, I think that's a really fair assessment. I feel like that's sort of where my holdup or my block when it comes to running old school style is that I'm so stuck in the mentality of how I learned how to play during the D&D third edition days that it's hard to rewire new neural pathways into like thinking about it differently and how to run the game differently. So part of, as like sort of a continuation of that question, that statement, you had said that a lot of this information has been found on blogs, and that's kind of what you've been talking about, that a lot of the old, the OSR references deal with that about, you know, what are the old ways and all that. Do you have a DMG or plan to write a DMG for either Osric or Swords and Wizardry?
Both of them contain DMG type information. It really depends on what you mean by DMG, because both of them do technically have that.
Yeah. Yeah, I maybe it's just because it's such a tradition in the sort of D&D way that things are packaged. So, you know, you have your player's book, you have your game master book, you have your monster book, and in theory, you don't really need to have separate books for each of these things. All the information could be put into one book and, you know, be accessible that way.
Which is how it's done in Swords and Wizardry. I mean, the one Swords and Wizardry book contains all of the information for both the player and for the referee. Okay. And Osric has been done that way. In this particular backer kit for Osric, we are splitting it out into a player guide and a GM's guide. But really the reason for that is because of the weight of the book that, you know, if you're a player, you know, you can be carrying around an cheaper and B less weighty book around with you. And so it's really splitting it out, you know, more for that reason than anything else.
So before I go on, cause what I really wanted to focus on in this interview was talking about, sort of answering some questions, game mastering questions that I had and that have been presented to me. But I seem to recall, I tried looking in the box set, because I have the Frog God Games version of the box set, there was a map of like a reference of a dungeon. And I believe it was in one of the earlier editions where it said, this is a level of the dungeon from Castle Mythmere. Now, was that your own personal mega dungeon, or was that like, what's the story with that?
It was a dungeon, because the way that I run games at conventions is that I say, you know, you start with a character with 2,000 experience points. But if you survive, then you can continue to bring that character. So it gives some meaning to whether you stay alive, because at a convention game one shot, you don't really care. And then, you know, it gives some meaning to the experience points, some meaning to, yay, I got a magic item treasure, because I can come back and play it later. So I did have a mega dungeon, that I was using. And I think it is still in the Swords and Wizardry complete revised rule book, that map. I'm not 100% sure, and can't do it without actually cracking the book open and looking. But yeah, that's my personal dungeon. But I don't have a mega dungeon that I've been developing for umpteen zillion years that, you know, thousands of players have been through. I haven't had one of those. You know, when I was a kid, I wrote one called Goblin Ear Crag, and I've done other things that fit the definition of Mega Dungeon. But, you know, I'm one of those people who's like, you know, yay, we're starting a new campaign with a new group of players. How about I do something new? And get and so, you know, that's how that's going to work.
I can totally relate to that. That I feel that. So there's no no Castle Mythmere Mega Dungeon book on the future. All right, fair enough. So the focus of this show is to help GMs run a better game. If you had just one piece of advice that you could offer to new or veteran GMs alike, what piece of advice do you think that would be?
Well, for new GMs in any system, I would say don't sweat the rules. Just make it, you know, if you run into anything that's, because the most important thing in running a game is the pacing. The imagery is important too, but you know, you're either good at that at the moment or you're not so good at that at the moment. And you know, your ability to tell a good story will develop. But if you're brand new, the most important thing is the pacing. And so if you have a rules question, don't let things break down into people taking a look through rule books to try and help you find an answer. Just be like, okay, it's going to be this way. And then if it turns out that was dead wrong, you can either decide to fix it or whatever you do down the road, but don't let the pacing slow down. Just go ahead and make a decision and own that decision and go with it, would be my advice to a newer GM. For an older, somebody who's more experienced in it, I would say, you know, because there you're assuming that somebody's already pretty well on top of the rules of whatever system they're using. So there I would say, develop your imagery. You know, it's like, you know, if you're, especially if you're playing at a tabletop, you know, develop the eye contact skills, get the ability to put excitement into your voice, you know, the ability to, you know, suggest that something, even while you're saying, oh yeah, that sounds like a great idea, to suggest that maybe it's not. That kind of thing is, I think, you know, that's probably the skill of somebody who has already mastered the rules and wants to get better at it, is probably the imagery.
I love that. Those pieces, I feel like both of those are great. I just wanted to take a step back for a minute. When you're talking about pacing, because I've had this, it's sort of come up, it's never really been super discussed, but I've had some people being like, pacing means that you got to keep the game going and it's got to run. And it's like the implication being that the game has to go super, super fast. And I disagree. I think if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, what you're saying is that, you know, the game is going to have its lulls, it's going to have its highs, and it's a question of like trying to keep things flowing without having these long pauses of nothing going on, because you're looking up a rule and now everybody's screwing around at the table. Would you say that that's an accurate assessment of what you're saying?
Yeah, different things going on in the game can have totally different pacing to them. But I think it breaks if people start to go outside of the game itself. But, you know, if I'm doing something where, you know, you're approaching a spooky statue, and, you know, and then it's absolutely fine for them to, you know, be going slowly, asking questions about what do I see. I mean, the fact that, you know, it's not pulp, you know, there's a difference between suspense, between, you know, fast moving combat, between, you know, what we're going to advance time by a couple of weeks because we're in the city, that's going to move at an entirely different kind of pace. So it definitely does not need to be always, you know, go, because the players are going to get tired if you're doing that too. But if it's supposed to be a fast moving, exciting combat, and it suddenly becomes a rules discussion, you know, that's something that you want to avoid. So it's, you know, so no, I totally agree with you. It does not need to be go all the time. That's like a business meeting where you're trying to get as much done as you can. And I don't think that's useful, but if it is supposed to be a fast paced combat, you don't want to suddenly slow it down either.
Right. Yeah. Okay, great. I'm glad we concur on something. So we talked about it. I don't remember if I mentioned it on the air, but I know off air we were talking about how I was running a Barrow Maze game. I'd started with Old School Essentials, so I apologize for not using your game. Clearly, it is it is the more superior version of, well, it is Old School Essentials is BX and Swords and Wizardry is
OD&D. OSE is based on a box set that came out in 1981, I think, that was written by it's usually called the Moldvay box set, and it duplicates a lot of the simplicities of OD&D that OD&D had that were made a little bit more complicated in AD&D. So there are actually more similarities than you would expect between OD&D and Moldvay Basic. But they are different games. OD&D had a much, much broader scope of, not just character classes, but just the sorts of things they would mention, strongholds, running into castles in the wilderness. So it was just a much broader scope game. But Moldvay was a very well done, and it's the reason why Moldvay is probably being used so widely, because there are other basic versions out there. Moldvay was a very good simplified version of the game, and that's why it's caught on. But the DNA, the DNA is very similar, but the two games are actually based on different rule sets.
Okay, so a lot of what I based these next few questions on were like from reading your old school primer, which I highly recommend people do because I think it is very insightful. But I was kind of hoping to get some kind of clarifications and answer some of the questions that people have mentioned to me before, and I don't really have a good answer for. So I'm just going to start with this. So in your primer, it says, what makes OE different from later games isn't the rules themselves, it's how they're used. And then later on in the rulings, not rules part, you say, rules are a resource for the referee, not for the players. Players use observation, description as their tools and resources. Rules are for the referees only. So one of the things that I've had people say to me is, well, if it's a rules light game and it's not, you're supposed to make rulings and not have a rule for every situation. Doesn't that force you, once you get into that situation, to have to create the rule on the fly to deal with that situation? And then for consistency's sake, you're going to need to reference that rule over and over again. So you're just sort of creating more work for yourself mid-game. How would you respond to that?
Right. So there's the sort of situational improvisation that you do as a DM when you're using, any old school game, whether it's, OSE or OD&D, AD&D, doesn't matter what it is. Okay. The answer to that question of, doesn't that mean I am creating a rule? The answer is no. What you're doing is you're saying this particular wall, let's just say that you're going to need a roll, a one or a two on a six-sided die to climb it or not. That doesn't have any implication for other walls. That's the sort of area that I'm talking about. You don't need a rule for example, climbing walls. I mean, thieves have it because it's part of their character class. And there you do need a number, because the fact that you're going toward rulings and not rules doesn't mean you don't have any rules. But thieves have a particular capability of climbing a wall. But, for example, third edition tried to clarify, the regular person climbing a wall, if it's a slick wall, then you've got this modifier. If it's a really, really tall wall, there's this modifier. It's like, look, just make up a number. You've got an idea in your head of what the wall looks like. You don't need to have a rule covering all wall climbing. You don't need to have a rule covering all diplomacy with a bartender in a tavern. You don't need to have those rules, because it is actually easier. And this is the thing, is I do think that DMs tend to be the people who are the most interested in playing an old school game. It is much easier actually to just say, I can picture in my head what this is, and I know what the probabilities are on a dice. So I can just say, you know, here's what we're going to do. Let's go. And then you're just moving on through it rather than, you know, because there are some things where you break into the play of a game, you know, the what's the chance of getting useful information out of the tavern keeper rule. You're going to spend, you know, a couple of minutes of killing the pacing of your game to find out what that rule is when it's already there in your head. You already know pretty much what the probability is. Don't screw with having rules. But that, you know, the publication, you know, the role of the publisher has always been to try and be like, well, people are saying they don't have a rule for this. Let's give them a rule for this. But when you keep repeating that process of, okay, here's a rule for this, okay, here's a rule for this, okay, here's a rule for this, you end up with something that's actually not the efficient mode for the way that the referee operates. From the vast majority of those things, you already know basically what the probability is, you know, or you can get it within a couple of seconds of thought. And you can even be like, you know what, I think I'm going to roll a, you know, I think I'm going to give you a one or a two on a six-sided die means success. Anybody got any objections to that? You think it ought to be three and six? Okay, that's fair. Three and six. Here we go. And go. So.
Okay. Yeah, I like that. So this is one of the weird things that's happened to me. So I know, like, one of the things you talk about is, like, describing, players describe what they want to do and how they're doing stuff. So for example, in your primer, you talk about you contrast between old school versus modern style of play when it comes to like searching for traps. And so one of my personal experiences was having my players going through the dungeon and they tell me I'm searching the door for traps. I'm searching the chest for traps. They tell me how they're doing it. I've had players be very detailed, how they're examining the room, looking under beds and carpets and all this kind of stuff. And I found that after 10 rooms of doing this, it becomes very, very tedious. How do you handle long-term exploration when that's sort of the style that you're trying to like encourage? And do you, if the player says that one time because they were just exhausted from constantly giving you this information, they forget to tell you, I told you the last time I looked above the door before I walked through to see if there was a mimic hiding up there. And now I'm getting attacked by a mimic.
Yeah. There's different approaches to that. A lot of DMs talk in terms of, standard operating procedure that they let people say, you know, in every room I'm doing this, 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 and this. I tend to do it in the way of, you know, the players will be like, okay, I'm going to look around in the room. If it makes a difference, I will say, where are you looking? But if it doesn't, if it's a totally empty room, I'm like, you're pretty sure that this room is empty.
Right.
And they're like, are we sure? You know, or whatever the, thing might be, but it's a back and forth. But the you've hit upon one of the points where somebody can go wrong by trying to follow the advice and the philosophy to the letter, because it will get very, very old if they feel like what you're actually playing is a gotcha game, where if I forget a thing, then, you know, then there's going to eventually be a bad result. And that's and that is something that you want to avoid. And, you know, there are a lot of times, you know, also where I'll be like, you know, okay, you, the player, did not tell me that you are looking up, but it's not a gotcha game. If you've looked up in the past three rooms, I'm going to say, okay, you go in just like you did in the other rooms, you look up. That, you know, and in one way that's breaking a big rule, because that's the referee telling a character what their character does. But where that fits in is that you're just, look, you've done it on all the other ones. You didn't mention it this time, but I'm absolutely going to give you credit for the fact that you're paying attention to remembering to look up. So the way I would describe it would be like you did in the other room. You poke your head up and, oh, you yank your head right back. There's a great big spider there. You know, it's all
right.
You know, there's one of the things about, you know, the sort of old school DMing with the quotation marks around it and so on, is that, you know, it's highly descriptive. It's very much back and forth with the players, but the language of that back and forth change is because it's not the players looking at the character sheet for a limited set of options that they've got. They're just in the situation describing what they would do. You know, do I think I can climb that wall? You know, so.
Right. So again, one of the things that you talk about is it says in your primer, it says original D&D and Swords and Wizardry are games of skill in which in a few areas where modern games just rely on the character sheet. So what would you say to people who say they don't feel like they have the skill to be able to explore a dungeon per se? Like, you know, the not using a 10-foot pole, or I think in the example for the trap, you talk about pouring some water out onto the floor to kind of identify that there's a pit trap there. Like, is there, do you think that,
well, I would say it's a game of developing those skills, you know, as you go. And, you know, certainly that might not, you know, appeal to everyone. I mean, I think there are different people have an image of what their characters are, and you definitely want to try and make sure that your group shares those things, because there's, you know, the group that want to be, you know, feeling like they're feeling their way in the dungeon, and there's a group that want to be heroes going through and not bother with, you know, the lesser details that are involved. You know, usually those folks just want to get to the, you know, the puzzles, if it's an old school game, or just to the combat. And so a lot of it is a matter of, you know, reading the room and knowing your audience in terms of the game, of the group that you're playing with. I mean, I was astonished one time when I was talking to, you know, some of my group of characters, and I'm like, you know, you want to have the risk of screwing up and having things go wrong. And one of my players is absolutely nodding his head. Yes, you want the risk. That's part of the thing. And then and I went on to say, you don't want it to be just like a movie where you're just succeeding. And one of the players said, yeah, I do. And I had people, you know, in this group, there was one player who was very much on the, you know, I play video games on the hardest level sort of approach. And there was somebody else who was like, no, I just want to relax and just, you know, sort of talk my way through a series of heroic successes where it's, you know, a sort of a wish fulfillment sort of a game. And there, and those, you know, and it was interesting that I had two people who I think were pretty far on both ends of that spectrum sitting in the same group. But I was astonished when he said, yeah, I do kind of want it to be like a movie.
So what would you be your suggestion for game masters and or players who feel like that's the style, like they want to have a more cinematic role-playing experience? Do you feel like maybe old school style play isn't for them, or do you feel like just take it upon yourself then to adapt the game to be more that way?
I would say that if somebody really wants just more cinematic, that they might want to pick the system based on cinematic. So something like, the name of the game goes right out of my head. Pulp Two-Fisted, I think it's Pinnacle.
Savage Worlds.
Thank you. You know, I think you might want to go for something that is more designed to produce, a cinematic game. Because certainly, you know, old school D&D, you're talking about a fairly small niche there. It certainly can produce real cinematic stuff, although it's likely to be a comedy cinema. But, I do think that if you really had a group of a lot of players who, you know, for whatever reason, you know, they've got high anxiety jobs, they really don't want to be focusing on the survival of a character, you know, that would absolutely be the kind of thing where you might decide to pick a different game system for it. You know, you could certainly nerf the risks on the thing. And I mean, a lot of people, you know, will, if they're playing one of the old school versions, they'll give, like, you know, maximum hit points at first level, things like that. You know, there are certain things that people do in order to nerf it, and they may bring up the character level so that people have more choices of spells so that you can get a more cinematic thing. But yeah, there are games that are designed to produce a cinematic effect. And I would certainly think if you had a whole group of people who were like that, I'd really think about saying, you know, hey, let's maybe pick the system based on what play experience we want to have.
Right. So I've had people numerous times now make this distinction where they're like, okay, so why isn't there a mechanical element for dealing with how to sweet talk yourself past a guard, or how to do some sort of other, like disable a trap, for instance? Like maybe somebody's like, I don't even know, I have no idea how mechanical things work. I don't know how you want me to describe this to you, but yet we do have a mechanical system for combat. And so people, like, I had one friend who said to me, he's like, listen, you're not asking me, why are you asking me to like give a speech when you wouldn't expect me to stand up here right now, whip out a sword and start sword fighting across the living room? And I'm like, no, it's a little bit of a ridiculous statement on one hand, but on the other hand, I could kind of see where he was coming at from that angle. So sure. What do you think about that?
Well, in terms of disabling a trap, there is a game mechanical system for that in virtually all of the old school stuff. It's, you know, thieves had the ability to do that. When you're dealing with a, something that in the old parlance would be a trick rather than a trap. So something that is more like, dealing with a statue that's holding a gem or something like that. And there, the question is, what are you going to do with that gem rather than can I disable whatever trap it might happen to be? And there you can see that there's the mental puzzle of what are you going to do with that gem? And so the real relevant question that you've got is the one about making a speech. And once again, it's partly about reading the rule. But the first off answer to the guy is because some people really like making speeches and because it's fun. And that's a way of, you know, doing the game. And if I am good at doing speeches and I want to do a great quick speech, why am I not getting a reward for the fact that I have just done, you know, an excellent speech, or that I, as a player, have come up with an awesome quick answer as to why do you need to be in the necromancer's lair? It's because we're the plumbers and we noticed that stream coming out the back. And so it's that kind of thing. So it's rewarding different things, but the counterpart to the, what if I'm not good at speeches is what if I am really good at making speeches? And so, and it's not a logical answer as to where the game should fall in the rules. It's got a lot to do with what's making the overall game fun. So that's, you know, that I think is the answer. And if somebody is playing a bard and they're really terrible at speeches, you know, I'd still be like, well, just go ahead and, you know, you got to tell me what your answer is. And then if it's really stupid, maybe what my thing is going to be is, you know, but you're so good at this that even though what you came out with, you still managed to persuade them and get on by, you know, so it really is. It's workarounds. But the thing is, you know, the logic of designing a game, there is no single chain of logic involved in designing a game. A lot of it has to do with the breakout question of what's fun. Is this a fun subsystem to use? Is this a fun improvisational aspect to use? Or is it not? And even that breaks down group by group, where with one group, you may be like, you know what, we're not going to do the math. With this other group, yes, we're going to do the math. You know, so game design is not pure logic.
Fair. So I guess this kind of goes in part with the skill question. So I guess it's kind of a two-parter. So going back to the concept of, like, let's say somebody who has learned, for instance, that trolls will regenerate unless you throw fire on them. Now, let's say you're a first level character. But the player themselves knows. So they have this metagame knowledge that this is the case. Do you feel like it's appropriate for that first level character who's never left the village before to know that? Or do you think, like, unless they've had some sort of knowledge, like, just, I think you know where I'm going with that.
I do. And I think there are sort of two different sort of types of game being described there. I'm a big fan of allowing player meta knowledge. It doesn't make a difference to me whether somebody knows or does not know that fire might affect a troll. It doesn't make a big difference to me whether people are limiting their. The only reason for limiting your knowledge to the character level is because you are focused on the role playing of being that character in that environment. And that's also a totally cool way to play. Again, if everybody in the group is on the same page, because if you run into somebody who wants meta knowledge and somebody who wants, you know, strict character role playing, then you're gonna have a problem in that group between those two players. But to me, and again, you know, it's because, you know, I tend to weigh toward the idea of thinking of D&D as being a game of skill, you know, like a video game where you are, you know, trying to beat the odds. That's one way of viewing it. I tend toward that direction, but there's also the you know, equally valid tendency of being like, I really want to be a hobbit today. And so I'm sticking myself into hobbit only knowledge. You know, I think in general, the old school community tends more toward the player skill side than toward the wrapping myself so much into my character that I may actually do things that even I know are stupid in this game, causing me to potentially, you know, lose the play of the game, you know, have the character die, whatever it is. And, you know, that's where you get people arguing. It's a game, you're not acting. It's role playing, you know, or you're putting too much game into it. You know, that I think is the distinction there. I have no problem with player meta knowledge.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's where, at least earlier on in like playing old school stuff, where I struggled was this tension that I felt between trying to reconcile playing a role versus playing a game, mm-hmm. right? And I feel like when you're using your player skill, you're sort of like going, okay, for instance, if I'm playing poker, I'm, you know, making sort of like calculations on, okay, you know, is this guy bluffing me? You know, what cards do I have? What are the odds of this happening? And so you're playing two separate, like you said, you're making two separate games. So,
You are absolutely playing two games simultaneously. And I would say that the old school ethos tends much more heavily to be based on the idea of you are playing to win rather than you are playing to evoke a character. But that idea of playing to evoke a character, which, you know, also dates back to, you know, 1974, this is not a new idea, but it became... You ran into a period of time in the game where suddenly all of the people, you know, suddenly seemed to be talking about role playing, and they were looking down their noses at the people who were trying to play with player skill. Well, of course, it's more important to be role playing your character. And, you know, I think a lot of the old stories were like, no, why is that the case? It's a game. You know, there is a skill element to it. What do I lose by not accurately portraying, you know, this particular, you know, hobby? It's a fairly minimal difference one way or the other. So,
okay. So one of the suggestions for like player longevity is to engage the services of hirelings and eventually get henchmen. And so I had this in my game where all of my players had hired people and I just sort of fudged it. I didn't actually use the role to say whether or not they accept your services or not. And maybe that's what I should have done, but I found it very difficult to run my dungeon, having like 10 characters plus animal companions running around this dungeon. How do you feel about that? What's your suggestion and about how to handle a massive party of PCs and NPCs?
Well, I mean, the first thing is that, you know, it's a lot easier to run a large number of people, you know, when you're using a simpler rule system in the first place, but you're already talking about a simpler rule system. So that's not the question you're asking. I tend to only, if they try and go in with an army, that army is very quickly going to suffer vast losses in a dungeon environment because most of those hirelings are not particularly sturdy. You know, so one poison gas trap, you're going to start losing people, and then no one's ever going to accept your offer of employment again after you come back with only 10% of the, you know, people who went in with you. And in fact, you know, you may have the, you know, the local authorities be taking a look at what you were doing there under, you know, Dungeon OSHA standards. But, you know, so, you know, that's the thing, is that if you're going to bring in, you know, a couple of torchbearers so that your characters can have their hands free, you need to be protecting those torchbearers as much as you can. And so I would suspect that there were just, you know, that when you were looking at, I guess, the OSE rules, you said it was the OSE that you were using.
Yeah.
That they may not have given, you know, the guidance about, you know, here are the downsides and how to handle it. But there are, you know, and I don't even know if those are in Swords of Wizardry now that you mention it, but, you know, there's long-term, you know, Dungeon Master lore, you know, is that there are absolutely a lot of restrictions on doing that. You want to, you know, it's not simply we're going to hire an army and go in. It's, you know, we're going to hire what we need. We're going to protect those people as much as we can. And it's obviously pretty risky for a torchbearer, but, you know, you're really going to do what you can. You're going to reward them well. And maybe they even, you know, end up being, you know, getting beyond zero level and becoming first level and becoming henchmen. You know, there are controls on that have been talked about in Dragon Magazine for years and years and years and years.
All right. Well, that's pretty much it for the questions that I have. It's been amazing. You've asked, you're super insightful, and what I've really taken away is that it's really a question about gauging your players at the table, the people that you're playing with, more than trying to cling closely to the rules. Which I guess comes back to that rulings over rules type of thing. So it's more of a, would you agree with
absolutely,
that?
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think, you know, knowing, and there's not much focus put on this. But you know, you really want to, understand the people who are at the table. And if it's at a, you know, if you're sitting down at a game store and you've never met the people before, then, you know, yeah, that may be an issue of, you know, what, my table's running this way. Maybe you'd be better off over at that table over there. Or the two of you guys are really not getting along. Why don't one of you go somewhere else? But, you know, but if you, you know, when you're in a group that's meeting, you know, repeatedly, whether online or in person, and you get to know them ahead of time, then yeah, I think absolutely, you know, as the DM, you want to be zeroing in on, you know, this player, you know, loves archaeology. Anything I give them that looks like an ancient artifact is something they're going to be really interested in. Maybe I'll even write a little bit of history about, you know, the cultures and the thing. And, you know, this guy, you know, really loves tactical combat. Let's put in, you know, I do think, you know, just as a, you know, you do adapt to the particular group of players, because every particular group of players is different.
Yeah, that's very true. Was there anything that you wanted to add that I hadn't mentioned that you felt was important?
No, I don't think so. I think you really hit on probably one of my major points with the whole thing of it's all about the, you know, the quote unquote social contract at the table, but also about knowing your players is,
right.
I think that's a, you know, a very important thing about, you know, running a long-term game.
All right. So where can we find you?
Oh, well, okay. So, MythmereGames.com is our store website, and we have a Discord, and I think that we've got a Discord link up in the on the website with the little invite code. If not, it's not hard to find out there. We do have a Swords and Wizardry Facebook group. We also have a page on Facebook, but that's mainly used, you know, as an outlet for when we're advertising a product more than discussion. I would say the Discord is probably the best place to get in touch with other Mythmere Game fans, and the place to get Mythmere Game products is MythmereGames.com, or finding us on DriveThru.
And I know that you're currently doing your Osric backer kit crowdfunding. Is there anything in the future that you can talk about? I know it's kind of weird to talk about something when you're doing something right now.
Yeah, we, this is the only crowdfunding we're doing this year, because at the moment we've got books that are lined up in a queue to get printed from the last one. And then that's, you know, slower because all of the people who were printing in China are now printing in the US. So the print queues have gotten longer. So we've got that. And then Osric is still, you know, I'm still probably a couple months away from finishing that draft. And I want to do some back and forth with a lot of people on Osric. So we're basically done for this year in terms of new crowdfunding. We're just going to focus on the various, you know, fulfillment elements, and then start again, you know, in next year on that. So I'm not plugging anything right now. If anybody, you know, wants to support us, go over to BackerKit, look for Osric 3, or else go to our, you know, website, Mythmere Games, if you're interested in the Swords and Wizardry stuff, you know, you can pick up a copy of Swords and Wizardry there.
Perfect. I put those all in the show notes. Awesome. So people will be able, they'll be able to find them there. And this is coming out on Monday, which is today is May the 10th. So it should be 11, 12. So May 12th, it's this episode should be coming out, and that will give you, what is it, 22 days, 23 days?
Plenty of time.
I think you have 23.
Plenty of time.
Yeah, so you have lots of time to still back it. Do it. I backed it myself, and I'm really excited to get my hands on this. I have Swords and Wizardry. I do have your Tome of Adventure hardback, the new one that you did, which is fantastic. The quality is amazing.
Thank you.
And I'm really, I'm trying not to buy as much stuff, but I've been looking at some of your other stuff, like the new Swords and Wizardry hardcover that is, they're such fantastic looking books, man. You guys made really great products, and they not only are they functional, but they look beautiful. So I think you guys got the whole package together as a company. I love it.
Thank you. Yeah, the appearance and functionality of the books is actually my partner Susie Mosby is the one who is responsible for what the books look like. If it were me, there'd be, you know, crayon pictures probably on there.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Matt, for coming on the show and sharing your thoughts and experiences with the Dungeon Plunger Union members. You will, you're always going to be a special Dungeon Plunger Union card holder. You got your gold card holder in our books.
I already talked about OSHA in the dungeon. So with the higher.
Exactly. Listen, that's the most important. Too many lives, too many dungeon plungers are losing their lives to mimics. It's not good. So thank you very much. And thanks for coming on. And I wish you great success going forward.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Thanks.
Thank you very much for listening to the show. And thank you very much again to Matt Finch from Mythmere Games to coming on the show and talking to us about old school role playing. I really am so honored and touched that he would come on the show. So thank you very much. Music is by Alexander Kizunaku. Cover art by John McNally. A special thanks to my loving and supportive wife. Behind every great man is a great woman, and her support for my nerdy hobbies means everything to me. Also, a special thanks to Ed for helping me create and voice some of the crazy characters found on the Dungeon Plunger podcast, and to Lucas Medeiros for editing the YouTube video. Thank you, buddy. I owe you one. Feel free to call in and leave me a message on my SpeakPipe at thespeakpipe.com/thedungeonplunger, or send an email at dungeonplunger@gmail.com. I'm also on Blue Sky as The Dungeon Plunger. And remember, when you're plunging into the dungeon and nature calls, watch out for mimics disguised as toilets. They're a pain in the butt.
Greetings, listener. This is I, Hector, the real Dungeon Plunger. Not that milk drinker Jason. We in the dungeon always appreciate whatever love you can give us. So please, share the podcast, send your messages, and do anything that will unclog our algorithm. We really appreciate it. Plungers up!